Through the lenses, he saw a husky man with gray hair looking back at him. At one point, the American lowered his binoculars and waved. Petrov ignored him. Their next encounter was not as friendly. A commercial airliner from a third-world nation had been mysteriously shot down in the Persian Gulf. Paranoia was the reigning national psychosis of the Cold War, and for reasons as vague as they were far-fetched, both countries suspected the other of complicity. Again, Petrov and Austin located the plane at the same time. Petrov's ship came close to ramming the American vessel, sheering off at the last second so Austin could see the heavily armed men on deck. Austin called Petrov and warned the Russian to improve his driving or he'd get a traffic ticket. Austin stubbornly refused to move out. An international incident was avoided only when ships from the plane's home nation showed up at the site to claim the jetliner. As the rival vessels steamed off in opposite directions, Austin radioed a goodbye message. "So long, Ivan. Till we meet again." Petrov had a short fuse in his younger days, and this arrogant American was annoying him. "You better hope that won't happen," he said with chilling directness. "Neither one of us will be happy with the outcome." 8 months later, Petrov's prediction came true. During the Cold War, the United States pursued a daring intelligence operation. When the secret was finally unveiled years later, one writer called it Blind Man's Bluff, a dangerous game played by a few intrepid sub-commanders and their crews, whereby they would bring their subs within a few miles of the Soviet coast to gather intelligence. One scheme involved planting an electronic pod to listen in on underwater communications cables. In his drab Moscow office, Petrov lit up one of the thin Havana cigars he had made on special order and puffed out a mouthful of smoke. His mind drifted back through the years, and in the purple cloud that swirled in front of him, he saw the morning mists rising off the dark, cold surface of the Barents Sea as his ship cut through the water at full speed. He had been in Moscow trying to extract funds for new equipment from a strategically placed apparatchik who was complaining about tight purse strings. One of Petrov's assistants had called and said that a strange message had been picked up from an unknown ship close to Russian shores. The coded message was short, as if the operator were in a hurry. The Soviet cryptographers were trying to decipher the message. The only reason someone would risk sending a message would be if he were in trouble, Petrov thought, as the bureaucrat blathered on. Petrov was well aware that American subs had come into the Barents Sea. Could one of these boats be in trouble? He broke off his meeting and caught a plane to Murmansk, where his survey ship was waiting. The vessel had supplemented its scientific gear with depth charges, guns, and a trained complement of armed marines. By the time his ship was underway, the code had been broken. The message consisted of one word: stranded. He ordered all ships and aircraft to be on the lookout for strange vessels on or under the surface. Despite the Soviets' vigilance, however, the Talon carried out a picture-perfect rescue operation. The American ship came in during the night with a Russian language expert on board who gave a phony identification when the ship was picked up on radar. The ID wasn't perfect, but it bought time. Another American submarine, whose propeller had been made to operate noisily, drew the Russians' attention away. The stranded submarine was in about 300 feet of water, sitting flat on the bottom, its power out after an electrical explosion. The 100-man crew was rescued in a matter of hours, using a special diving bell. Petrov had finally figured out the decoy ruse and was speeding in his ship to the rescue site. The ship followed the communications cable until magnetometer readings showed a huge mass of ferrous material. It could only be the U.S. sub. A ship was rapidly moving out of the area, and Petrov recognized the Talon. Speaking in English, Petrov hailed the ship by its name and ordered it to stop. A familiar voice responded over the radio. "Ivan, is that you?" said the man who called himself John Doe. "Nice to hear your voice again. Prepare to be boarded or your ship will be sunk." A roar of laughter burst from the radio. "Hell, Ivan, I thought you Russians were better chess players than that." "Frankly, I prefer stud poker." "Which is obviously where you learned how to bluff. Nice try, comrade. This is your last warning. Aircraft will be overhead in 5 minutes, and your ship will be destroyed if you don't stop." "Too little and too late. We'll be in international waters in 3 minutes. Our state and defense departments are aware of the situation. Looks like you're out of luck." "I don't think so. We still have your submarine and its contents, Mr. Doe. Our scientists will have a field day dissecting your top-secret equipment." "That's not going to happen, old pal." "I think it will. The Glomar Explorer isn't the only boat that can raise a submarine." Petrov was referring to an earlier U.S. salvage of a Soviet submarine. "I wouldn't get near that boat if I were you. It's heavily mined." "Now, who's bluffing, Mr. Doe?" "I'm dead serious, Ivan. The sub carried 200 pounds of HBX explosives in case something like this happened. Why would you care if I were killed?" "Look, Ivan, the Cold War is not going to last forever. Someday we'll bump into each other in a bar and you'll buy me a Stolichnaya Martini." His voice lost its levity. "No joke. This thing will self-destruct in about 20 minutes. I set the timer myself." "You're lying." "People like us don't lie to each other, old pal." It was Ivan's turn to laugh. "You've seen too many episodes of Mission Impossible, old pal." He clicked off the radio. There was no way the crew could have been evacuated and set charges. He didn't know about Austin's expertise. He could have waited 20 minutes to see if Austin was telling the truth, but he seethed with anger. His rage overcame his good judgment. Petrov's ship carried a one-person mini-sub that could be launched quickly for reconnaissance, and Petrov ordered the sub readied for a dive. Sitting in his office, years after that day, he examined the grayish-red glow of cigar ashes. How impetuous and foolish he had been as a younger man. He had jammed the bomb-shaped sub almost straight down. Within minutes, his lights had outlined the black hulk on the bottom, and he saw the pod near the cable and landed near it. The mini-sub's retractable metal arm had the pod in its grip, when there was a blinding flash of light and a muffled roar. Petrov felt himself flying into space. Then he blacked out. He awoke to the antiseptic smell of a Soviet hospital. His broken and mangled leg was in traction, and the right side of his face was heavily bandaged, where jagged shards of plastic or metal had torn his skin as the mini-sub had been blown to the surface, where it had been retrieved with him inside it. He had had to wear a hearing aid until his damaged eardrums healed. He spent 4 weeks in the hospital before being released to the care of a nurse at his dacha, the country home he maintained outside of Moscow. Petrov had been sitting in the sunroom reading Tolstoy when the nurse brought him a bouquet of red, white, and blue carnations. Tucked in with the flowers was a small card. Thinking back to that day, Petrov pulled an envelope from the dossier. The card he extracted had yellowed with age, but the large block letters in English were clearly visible. "Sorry you got nailed, Ivan. Can't say I didn't warn you. Get well soon so we can have that drink. First round's on me. John Doe." Austin had almost ended his life and career. Now the same man was poking around where he could derail Petrov's carefully laid plans. Austin could not know how dangerous his meddling was, how precarious the situation was in Russia. Throughout his country's history, it had been afflicted with uncaring, inept, even psychopathic leaders. Petrov was one of thousands of faceless clones who did the bidding of their masters without question and kept them in power. Now his fragile nation seemed poised for another orgy of self-destruction. The furies welling up in the soul of Mother Russia would soon sweep across the country from Siberia to St. Petersburg. Petrov read the card again, then lifted the phone. "Yes, sir," answered a trusted assistant who occupied an office in another part of the agricultural building. "I want a plane ready to leave for Istanbul in 1 hour." Petrov gave orders to call his mistress and cancel their dinner date. "Is there any particular message you would like me to give, Miss Kostikov?" the assistant asked. Petrov pondered the question. "Yes," he said after a moment. "Tell her I must go to repay a favor to an old friend." Chapter 7. Novorossiysk, the Black Sea. The bearded man sat on the carpeted floor of the darkened cabin, legs folded in a lotus position, his rough peasant's hands clasped loosely in his lap. He had been locked in the same pose for more than 2 hours, the only sign of life the slight rise and fall of his narrow chest. His pulse was barely discernible, and his lethargic heartbeat would have alarmed a cardiologist. The heavy-lidded eyes over the prominent nose were closed, but he was neither asleep nor awake. The thick lips were curled in a beatific smile. Unseen, behind the thorny brambles that guarded the dense thicket of his mind, lurked the unfathomable musings of a madman. A soft knock came at the door. The bearded man showed no sign that he had heard it. The knock repeated, louder and more insistent this time. "Yes," the man said in Russian. His deep voice sounded as if it issued from the depths of a catacomb. The door opened a crack, and a young man dressed in the uniform of a ship's steward peered into the room. Light from the passageway fell on the face of the sitting man. The steward murmured a silent prayer his grandmother had taught him to ward off demons. Mustering the courage to speak, he said, "Forgive the interruption, sir."
"What is it?"
"Mr. Ratsov asks to see you in the main cabin." Deep-set eyes of pale yellow opened and stared out of the bony skull. They were the hypnotic eyes of a predator, large and lustrous. A pause. Then,
"Tell him I will be there."
"Yes, sir." Under the spell of the unrelenting gaze, the terrified steward felt the strength start to leave his legs. He slammed the door shut and bolted along the passageway. The man unfolded his body and stood to his full height of 6'4". He was dressed in a belted tunic of black cotton. The military collar of his shirt was tight against the neck, and his pants were tucked into low boots of shiny black leather. His dark brown hair was worn long over the ears, blending into a full beard that spilled down to his chest. He worked the stiffness from his muscles joint by joint and took great gulps of air into his starved lungs. When all his vital systems were operating normally, he opened the cabin door, ducked his head, and stepped out into the corridor. Moving silently, he followed the passageway and climbed onto the deck of the 400-foot yacht. Crewmen, who saw him coming, stepped aside. The yacht had been designed with a wide, uncluttered deck and low, streamlined superstructure that minimized wind resistance. Based on a design for a fast ship freighter, the vessel was built with a deep V-shaped bow that cut through the waves and a concave stern that reduced drag. Powered by gas turbines and using an innovative water jet propulsion system, the vessel could go at speeds that were twice those reached by vessels of comparable length. The bearded man came to a door, opened it without knocking, and stepped into a spacious stateroom as big as a small house. He walked through the living area with its sofas and chairs and a dining table of medieval size. The floors were carpeted with antique Persian rugs, any one of which was worth a small fortune. On the walls were priceless masterpieces, most stolen from museums and private collections. At the far end of the room was a massive desk made of the finest mahogany inlaid with gold and pearl. On the wall behind the desk was a stylized logo that depicted a military fur hat crossed by an unsheathed saber. Printed in Cyrillic letters under the symbol were the words, Ottoman Industries. Seated at the desk, talking into a telephone, was Mikhail Rasov, president of Ottoman. Although Rasov hardly spoke above a whisper, his seemingly gentle tone couldn't mask the cold menace in his voice. His pale white face could have been carved from Carrara marble, but no one would mistake the hard-edged profile as the work of a Renaissance sculptor. It was a face that countless victims had seen with their dying breath. Two lean, white Russian wolfhounds lounged at his feet. When the tall man approached, they began to whimper. Rasov hung the phone up and shushed the dogs, who crawled under his desk. Rasov underwent an astounding metamorphosis. Unexpected warmth came into the slate-gray eyes. The cruel lips widened in a smile, and the rough-hewn features softened. Rasov could have been anyone's favorite uncle. Career criminals like Rasov become accomplished actors if they live long enough. Rasov had cultivated his natural chameleon's talent under the tutelage of professional actors. In an instant, he could transform himself from a murderous thug into a hard-driving businessman, a charming host, or a charismatic orator. Rasov's powerful shoulders and muscular thighs offered a hint of humbler beginnings. Born on the steppes of the Black Sea, the son of a Cossack horse breeder, Rasov had ridden from the time he was big enough to climb into a saddle. He'd had a keen mind and quickly saw the disadvantages of the brutal farm toil that had killed his mother and was ruining his father's health. He ran away to the city and put his muscle to work as an enforcer for a gang of extortionists. Rasov's skill as a bone crusher and killer earned him top wages. He had forgotten how many times he had put a bullet into the kneecap of a recalcitrant merchant or the head of a tardy loan customer. He'd lost count of the wayward prostitutes he had strangled. In fact, he'd used his newfound wealth to buy a house of prostitution for himself. Soon, by eliminating his former employers, he gained control of a network of brothels. He protected his investment with a private army of ruthless thugs and branched out into gambling, drugs, and loan sharking. With generous bribes and strategic killings, Rasov put himself beyond the reach of Soviet authority and became a multimillionaire. He'd become the quintessential Soviet mobster, and it seemed as if he would go on until a more aggressive rival surfaced. The bearded man came over and stood in front of Rasov's desk, hands clasped in front of him. "You called for me, Mikhail."
"Boris, my dear friend and advisor, I'm sorry if I disturbed your meditation, but there is important news."
"The test was a success, then?"
Rasov nodded.
"The early damage reports are most impressive, considering the small scale of the experiment."
He hit a button on the desk, and an orderly appeared, as if by magic, with a tray, two glasses, and a bottle of vodka. Ratsov poured the glasses full and handed one to Boris. Dismissing the orderly, he indicated a chair, took a seat opposite, and raised his glass in toast. Boris's large Adam's apple bobbled as he noisily slugged his drink down. He drained the glass as if the contents were no stronger than herbal tea and wiped his mouth with the back of his hairy hand.
"How many dead?" he said, hardly able to control his eagerness.
"One or two," Ratsov said with a shrug. "Apparently there was a warning."
The monk's strange eyes blazed with a killing anger.
"An informer?"
"No. It was completely unanticipated. A fisherman warned the townspeople, and the harbor was evacuated."
"A pity," Boris said, with genuine sadness in his voice. "We must be sure, next time, that there is no warning."
Ratsov nodded in agreement and pointed to a large computer-generated monitor on one wall. The screen displayed a map of the world. It sparkled with lights that showed the positions of the far-flung Ottoman fleet. Using a remote control, he zoomed in on the map to bring up a line of lights assembling off the east coast of the United States.
"Our assets are moving into position."
His eyes grew colder.
"I can assure you that when we have accomplished our work, there will be many dead to count, and much more."
Boris smiled.
"Then the North American project is on schedule?"
Ratsov refilled their glasses. He seemed troubled.
"Yes and no. There are some matters of vital importance that I want to discuss with you. They have a bearing on our plans. We must deal with an unexpected problem. There have been intruders at our Black Sea operation."
"Moscow has heard of our activities?"
"The fools in Moscow are still unaware of our plan," Ratsov replied with unveiled contempt.
"No, it was not the central government.
An American television crew landed near the old submarine pen."
"Americans?"
He lifted his arms toward the sky.
"A gift from heaven," he said, eyes glittering. "I hope their necks felt the sharp edges of the Guardian's blades."
"To the contrary, there was a fight, and the Guardians were driven off. Some of your men died in the struggle."
"How could that be, Miguel?
The Guardians are trained to kill without mercy."
"True, they are superb horsemen, Cossack warriors in the finest sense. Their weapons are traditional but effective."
"Then how could an unarmed television crew resist?"
"They were not alone," Ratsov said, scowling.
"Apparently, they had help from an aircraft."
"Military?"
Ratsov shook his head.
"My sources tell me the aircraft was launched from a ship called the Argo. The vessel is supposedly in the Black Sea to conduct a scientific survey for Numa."
"What is this Numa?"
"I've forgotten that you were isolated from the outside world for many years. The National Underwater and Marine Agency is the largest oceanic science organization in the world. They have thousands of scientists and engineers spread across the globe. The pilot of the aircraft, the man who killed the Guardians, was one of those scientists."
Boris stood and paced the cabin.
"This report concerns me. How could scientists or engineers defeat
armed warriors? A good question. I don't know. I'm certain of one thing, however. This is not the end of it. I have ordered preparations made to move our operations. Meanwhile, extra guards will be posted. I have taken the liberty of arming them with more contemporary weapons. I'm sorry. I know how you feel about preserving the purity of our traditions. I understand the need to be ready to face impure forces. What of your source in Washington? His power is limited, but I have asked him to do what he can without jeopardizing his role. We must know who and what we are dealing with, Boris said. This Numa may not be what it says it is. Agreed. It would be folly to underestimate them, as the Guardians did. Tell me about these television people. I have confirmed that they were from an American network. Two men and a woman. Boris stroked his beard and thought. This is no accident. The television people and this Numa must be a cover for an American scheme. Where are they now? On the Argo, heading back to Istanbul. I've dispatched a boat to follow her. Can we destroy the Numa ship? As easily as smashing an insect, but I don't think it would be wise at this time. It might draw attention to our Black Sea venture. Then we must wait. I agree. After the Black Sea venture is done, then you may take your vengeance. I defer to your wisdom, Mikhail. Radsov's smile had all the warmth of an anaconda's. No, Boris. It is you who is the wise one. My expertise is business and politics, but you have the vision for the great and grand future. A vision you will carry out as the lone defender against the corruption and materialism that is a cancer in our once great country. We must show the world that our cause is right. Nothing must stand in the way of our plan to carve out decay where we find it. I want you to see something, Ratzov said. He punched a button on his desk. This is my most recent speech before the army. A picture appeared on the wall screen. Ratzov, speaking in a large hall. The audience was made up of men in the uniforms of the various Russian armed services. Ratzov stepped onto the stage, and within minutes he had his audience in the palm of his hand. As he spoke, he seemed to grow to 10 feet high. Drawing on the power of his deep voice, impressive physique, and his convictions to exhort the crowd. We must honor the warrior creed of our Cossack brothers. Our people threw off the yoke of the Ottoman Empire and defeated Napoleon. The Cossacks took Azov for Peter the Great and have defended the borders of Russia against intruders for centuries. Now, 7 million strong, with your help, we will destroy the enemies within, the financiers, the criminals, and the politicians who would grind our country to dust beneath their boots. Before long, the crowd was on its feet in a frightening example of mass hysteria. They surged toward the podium with glazed eyes, arms reaching out. They wanted to be part of him. They were chanting, Radsov, Radsov, Radsov. He flicked off the television. You have learned well, Mikhail, Boris said. No, Boris. You have taught me well. I merely showed you how to draw upon the passions of our people. This is nothing compared to what is to come, but much depends on our Black Sea work. I was talking to the salvage ship when you arrived. There are many difficulties, but they are close to their goal. I told them that their lives depended on success. I will not accept failure. Do you wish me to look into the future?
Yes. Tell me what you see.
Boris bent his head and touched his fingers to his brow. His eyes became glassy. Speaking as if his voice were coming from a cave, he said,
I prophesy that the day will come when you take the reins as the new Tsar of Mother Russia. All our enemies will be vanquished. The United States will be the first to feel the sword of righteousness.
What else do you see? His forehead furrowed as if he were in pain, and his voice became hollow.
Cold and blackness. A place of death under the sea.
He reached out and grabbed Ratsov's arm, digging his fingers into the flesh like daggers.
There is light.
The thick lips curled into a beatific smile.
Success is within reach.
Life returned to the stony eyes.
The ghosts of the dead will soon bestow their blessing on our cause. They plead for you to seek revenge in their name.
Ratsov had been a successful gangster and was a creature of the city. Once out of his element, he was practically helpless. Ratsov thought back to his first meeting with Boris. He had been wandering, lost and half-starved through the bleak countryside when he came upon a stream of peasants. There were dozens of them, frail and sick, some unable to walk, carried by others. When he asked where they were going, they replied that they were going to the monastery to be cured by the Mad One. Having nothing else to do, he followed. He saw the crippled throw away their crutches and walk, and blind people claim they could see. When he went up to Boris, the monk had gazed at him as if they had known each other forever, and said,
I have been expecting you, my son.
Under the gaze of those remarkable eyes, Ratsov had poured out his story. His shock at his father's dying words, his retreat from civilization and his wanderings in the wild country around the Black Sea. Boris told him to stay after the others had left, and they talked through the night. When Ratsov asked where the other monks were, Boris only said they were unworthy. Ratsov suspected the horrible truth, but it made no difference. When he returned to civilization, the bizarre figure of the bearded monk was at his side, and he had been at his side ever since. Eventually, other mobsters had moved into Ratsov's territory. At Boris's suggestion, he'd sent out word that he was abandoning his turf, and he made sure his sordid past would not come back to haunt him. First, he changed his name. Then, after several assassinations, some arson fires and bombings, he had wiped out most connections to his criminal days. Using the millions stashed in Swiss bank accounts and the strong-arm methods that had served him well as a criminal, he'd bought into mines that were slipping from communist control. Soon, he expanded his mining interests into the sea. Observers noted a mysterious and profound bond between the two men. Ratsov consulted Boris on all crucial decisions, and he rewarded Boris handsomely. The monk himself was a study in multiple personality. His stateroom on the yacht was furnished with only a cot, where he spent many hours in meditation, and he would go for long periods without washing. Sometimes, however, When the yacht was in port, he disappeared. Ratsov had Boris followed and learned that the monk had been spending his time in the seediest brothels. Boris seemed to be struggling with his two sides, the ascetic monk and the murderous voluptuary. For all his madness, though, the monk was a valuable advisor, his insanity tempered by a rational intelligence. In this case, Boris was right about Numa. It might prove a menace waiting in the wings. Chapter 8. The Black Sea. Following in the wake of the original Argo, the Numa ship steamed across the Black Sea toward the Bosporus, the narrow strait that separated the Asian and European sides of Istanbul. Unlike Jason, who brought home the Golden Fleece, all that Austin had to show for his labors was a head laceration, a bedraggled television crew, and a pile of unanswered questions. The evacuation from the Russian beach had gone off without a hitch. Captain Atwood had sent a boat in to transport Austin and the television people to the Argo. Moving the Goonie was less trouble than anticipated. It was mostly a case of picking up the pieces. Austin didn't look forward to telling Zavala that the nifty little plane he'd designed could practically fit into a shoebox. On the final run to the beach, Austin had spotted something floating in the water. It was the body of the Turkish helmsman, Mehmet. They'd hauled the body onto the tender and brought it back to the ship. The pitiful sight reminded Austin of the deadly game he'd been playing. One wrong roll of the dice, and it would have been his body, pulled from the water and wrapped in a tarpaulin. Austin checked in with the ship's paramedic to have his cut treated, then showered and changed. He had suggested to Kaela that she meet him for dinner in the mess hall after she had a chance to rest. Austin snagged a table next to a big window that looked out over the stern deck. He was gazing out at the ship's foamy wake, trying to make sense of the skirmish on the beach when Kaela made her entrance. The reporter wore jeans and a faded blue chambray shirt borrowed from a female oceanographer whose figure must have been shorter and wider. What would have been practical but ill-fitting work clothes on another woman achieved an elegant sophistication draped against Kaela's slim physique. As she entered the mess, she could have been strolling down a Paris runway wearing the latest in avant-garde fashion. She smiled at Austin and came over to the table. Something smells good. You're in luck. The chef has decided on an Italian theme. Have a seat. She sat down and closed her eyes.
Don't tell me.
She inhaled the aromas coming from the galley. An antipasto of truffle salad and olive mushrooms, followed by a porcini risotto. Not quite. Austin cleared his throat. We're having pizza. Mushroom, or pepperoni if you'd prefer carne. Kaela opened her eyes and stared at Austin. What happened to the four-star chef? Austin tried his best to look angelic, but his rugged features wouldn't cooperate. I confess, I exaggerated. My intentions were entirely honorable. Your spirits needed a lift back there on the beach. And you looked like you'd pushed your face through a plate glass window. Glad to see you're in better shape. Amazing, the miracles that can be performed with a needle, sutures, and swabs. Kaela glanced over at the serving counter. How's the pizza? Almost as good as Spago's, especially when you have nectar like this to wash it down. He reached under the table and produced a bottle of Brunello Chianti Classico. I picked up a case when we stopped in Venice. You're full of surprises, aren't you? Kaela said, laughing. Sorry the dinner is not quite as advertised, but you'll have to admit that the Waterview table is as promised. No argument there. The view is spectacular. She rose and said, If you open the bottle, I'll get our dinner. She grabbed a tray and stepped into the serving line. A few minutes later, she returned with two personal-sized pizzas and Caesar salads. Austin had the wine opened and poured their glasses. They hungrily attacked their dinner.
"This pizza is incredible," Kayla said.
She sipped the wine with a dreamy expression on her face. Suddenly, she glanced around as if she had lost something.
"Have you seen Mickey and Dundee?"
"I meant to tell you. The boys grabbed something to eat earlier, then went up to the bridge to shoot some video. Seems they've charmed their way past Captain Atwood's gruff facade. The camera tends to bring out the ham in people." Austin refilled their glasses.
"Tell me about your Noah's Ark assignment."
"It's the usual combination of humbug and fact that Unbelievable Mysteries packages for the mass TV audience. They splice old, blurry images with new footage and do a dramatic voiceover, heavy on the mysterious background music. There's usually a hint of government cover-up and some danger to the crew. The viewers love it."
"The danger was real this time."
"Yes, it was," she said thoughtfully.
"That's why I feel so bad about Captain Kamal's cousin. It was my idea to look into the old sub-base."
"Don't blame yourself. There was no way you could have known you'd be shot out of the water."
"Still, has anyone been able to contact Captain Kamal?"
"The bridge got in touch with him a while ago. Apparently his radio is working now. The captain gave him the bad news."
"Poor Mehmet. I keep playing that scene over and over again in my head. His family must be devastated."
Austin gently tried to take Kayla's mind off a situation she couldn't alter. "If you're looking for Noah's Ark, wouldn't you do better poking around Mount Ararat?" Kayla welcomed the chance to change the subject.
"No, not especially. You're familiar with the findings of William Ryan and Walter Pittman?"
"They're the Columbia University geologists who speculated that the Black Sea was originally a freshwater lake before the Mediterranean broke through the Bosporus in a great flood. The people who lived along the shore had to run for their lives."
"Then you must know that the saga of the flood, passed down by generations of bards, may have inspired the tale of Noah and the Ark, which means that the Ark sailed these waters. It would be a waste of time humping our cameras up the side of Mount Ararat, don't you agree?"
Austin leaned back in his chair and gazed into the dark amber eyes. They sparkled with good-humored intelligence. "I'll answer that with a question of my own."
"Let me guess. You want to know why someone who pretends to be a serious reporter ended up on the television equivalent of a supermarket tabloid."
Austin added perceptiveness to the list of Kayla's other admirable qualities. "I've seen your show. In the episode I watched, Bigfoot had been found living in Loch Ness with an alien love child."
"That must have been before my time, but I take your point. UM is trash television at its trashiest."
Austin spread his hands. "So?"
"It's a long story."
"We've plenty of time to talk. I'll have the sommelier refill your wine glass as often as you'd like."
"That's the best offer I've had all day."
She cradled her chin in one hand and gazed into his face. There was no timidity in her large eyes.
"I'll tell you about my background if you do the same for yourself."
"Okay, you're on." She took another sip of Chianti.
"I was born in Oakland, California. I was named Catherine after my dad's mother, and Ella after Ella Fitzgerald, Mom's favorite singer. My last name was Doran. I shortened it to Kayla Dorn when I went into TV. My mother was a ballet instructor at an African-American community center, and my dad was an Irish-American, long-haired, pot-smoking hippie who had come to Berkeley to protest the Vietnam War and everything else. There was a lot of that in the 60s.
She nodded.
"Did
Dad put aside his love beads and bongos and now teaches courses in contemporary American history at Berkeley, specializing in the protest movement of the 60s and 70s. He still has his beard, but it's a lot wider than it used to be. Happens to the best of us, Austin said, pointing to his prematurely steel-gray hair. I was something of a rebel as a kid. Pop's fault. One day Mom came down to the corner where I was hanging out with a gang and dragged me into her ballet classes where she could keep an eye on me. I traded in my gangsta colors for a tutu. I wasn't a bad dancer. The woman sitting across from Austin seemed made for dancing. I would have been surprised if you were any less graceful than a Pavlova. Thank you, she said. I was fair, but tripping about on my toes in the Nutcracker suite didn't satisfy my craving for adventure. Pop's fault, too. He bummed around Khartoum and New Delhi before he headed west to pull us out of Vietnam single-handedly. I went to Berkeley and studied English Lit, then I got accepted as an intern at a local TV station that wanted to fill its minority hiring quota. I got tired of reading gory reports about car crashes off a teleprompter. When I read about the opening at Unbelievable Mysteries, I jumped at the chance to travel to exotic, offbeat places and be paid pretty well for it. Okay, that's me. How about you? How did you come to be rescuing maidens and their friends in distress? Austin gave a condensed version of his biography, omitting his service in the CIA, stretching a fact here and there to make the pieces fit. Kayla listened intently, and if she detected his effort to massage the truth, she didn't show it. I'm not surprised that you like fast boats, or that you collect antique dueling pistols, and even that you listen to progressive jazz. I'm more surprised to hear that you study philosophy. I don't know if study is the right word. I like to say I've read a few books on the subject. He paused in thought, then said, One cannot conceive anything so strange and so implausible that it has not already been said by one philosopher or another. René Descartes. Which means? I see a lot of strange things and people in my business. It gives me comfort to know that as far as philosophy is concerned, there is nothing new under the sun. Greed, avarice, evil, and conversely, goodness, generosity, love. Plato once said, Austin became conscious of Kayla's stare. Sorry, I sound like a professor. I've never met a professor who swoops down out of the sky to do single-handed battle with a bunch of cutthroats. She regarded him with leveled eyes. Tell me, what exactly is your special assignments team? Somebody mentioned it to me before I came out here. There's no exactly about it. There are four of us, each with an area of expertise. Joe Zavala is a marine engineer who designs many of our vehicles. The ultralight I flew in on was his creation. He can pilot anything under or above the sea. Paul Trout is a deep ocean geologist with credentials from Wood's Hole Oceanographic and Scripps Institute. His wife, Gamay, is a diver and marine biologist with a background in nautical archaeology. Impressive. You still haven't told me what your team does. Depends. In general, we handle undersea assignments that tend to be other than routine. Austin failed to mention that those assignments often took place secretly outside the realm of government oversight. She snapped her fingers. Of course. Now I remember. The Christopher Columbus tomb in the Yucatan. You were involved in its discovery. Somewhat. It was a NUMA project. Fascinating, Kayla said. I'd like to do a story on your team. The NUMA Public Affairs Department would love it. Favorable publicity comes in handy when we go before Congress with our budget. Give them a jingle when you get back. I'll be glad to help. Thanks. I'd appreciate that very much. Now, let me ask you a question. What do you intend to do with the footage your crew filmed back in Russia? I'm not sure, she said with a furrowed brow. We don't have much except the dead body of a guy dressed up like a doorman at a Russian nightclub. She broke out in laughter. Not that the lack of facts ever discouraged unbelievable mysteries from cooking up a story. Maybe he's one of those UFO aliens you're always finding, Austin offered. Not with that sort. Kayla shuddered at the memory. Seriously, Kurt, what's your take on this whole thing? Who were those guys, and why were they so touchy about an abandoned sub-base left over from the Cold War? Austin shook his head. I can't answer those questions. You must have given it some thought. Of course. I don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to conclude that there's something there that someone didn't want us to see. I just don't know what it could be. There's one way to find out, Kayla said. Go back for a look. I don't think that would be wise. Austin ticked off the reasons on his fingers. We can sit here and laugh at a bunch of guys who look as if they came out of a production of Boris Godunov, but dumb luck is the only reason we're still alive. Second, since you don't have Russian visas, you would have to enter the country illegally. Third, you don't have a way to get there. Kayla countered each point on her own fingers. I appreciate your concern, but first, we'd be more prepared than we were and would get out in a hurry at the first hint of danger. Second, lack of a visa didn't stop you from landing on Russian soil. And third, if I can't get Captain Kamal to go back, I'm sure other fishermen are willing to earn in a couple of days what it takes them a year to make otherwise. Austin laced his hands behind his head. You don't discourage easily. I don't intend to stay with Unbelievable Mysteries forever. A story like this could be my ticket to a big job with a major network. So much for my incredible powers of persuasion, Austin said. Since you appear to have your mind made up, maybe I can convince you to accompany me on a tour of Istanbul at night. Topkapi Palace is a must-see, and there are some great shops around the Süleymaniye Mosque where you can pick up some gifts for the folks back home. We can wrap up the evening with dinner on board one of the Lufa boats. Another four-star chef? Not quite, but the scenery is special. I'm staying at the Marmara Hotel on Taksim Square. I know where it is. How about 7 o'clock the day we dock? I'll be looking forward to it. Austin saw little of Kayla the rest of the trip. She was busy with her two colleagues interviewing the captain and crew or working on background for NOAA. He contacted NUMA headquarters and filed a report on the Russian incident and spent the rest of the time trying to piece the Goonie back together. The Argo made good time, and before long they were making their passage past the villages and old forts along the Bosporus. The two-hour passage through the Bosporus was never dull. The narrow 17-mile waterway is considered the world's most dangerous strait. Captain Atwood threaded the Argo around tankers, ferries, and passenger boats as he made the 12 course changes necessary during the final leg of the voyage. The strong current that ran from the Black Sea to the Sea of Marmara made life even more interesting. Those on board let out a collective sigh of relief as the survey ship passed the ferry terminals and cruise ship docks to tie alongside a pier near the Galata Bridge. From the ship, Austin watched the television crew stuff its gear into a cab. Kayla waved goodbye, and the cab headed away from the waterfront. He walked around the deck, taking in the view of the bridge guarding the mouth of the Golden Horn and the sprawling Topkapi Palace built for the Sultan Mehmet II in the 1400s. In the distance, he could see the minarets of the Hagia Sophia and the Blue Mosque. He went back to his cabin and caught up on paperwork, then showered and exchanged his shorts and sweatshirt for casual slacks and a light cotton sweater. Near dinner time, he walked down the gangway and made his way to the street to look for a cab. A taxi pulled up beside him. It was a vintage Chevrolet circa 1950s. There were passengers in the car, which identified it as a dolmus, meaning stuffed in Turkish. Unlike the regular cabs, these taxis crammed in as many passengers as they could fit. Austin got into the back seat with two other passengers who made space between them. A heavyset man sat on a jump seat, and a third passenger occupied the front seat next to the meter. Austin told the driver to take him to the Taksim Square. He had visited Istanbul several times on Numa assignments and knew the city fairly well. When the cab went a roundabout route, Austin thought it was simply to accommodate the other passengers. But nobody got off. The cab started to head away from Taksim Square, and suspecting the driver was trying to jack up the fare, Austin leaned forward and asked him where he was going. The driver stared silently ahead, but the man in the front seat turned around. He had a wide, brutish face that even a mother couldn't love. Austin's eyes lingered on the passenger's features for only a second before shifting to the gun in the man's hand. "Silence," the man growled. The men sitting next to Austin pulled him back by the shoulders. A long-bladed knife pointed at his right eye. The cab accelerated at neck-snapping speed, exited from the traffic stream, and plunged into a dark maze of narrow cobblestone lanes. They headed away from the waterfront, skirting Karakoy and the police squads who monitored the official red light district. Austin glanced longingly at the restaurant lights at the top of Galata Tower. Then the taxi was moving along the İstiklal Caddesi, weaving in and out of traffic, past the nightclubs, movie theaters, and unregulated brothels that lined the gaudy strip. The cab spun off the main drag and climbed a hill into Bozoglu, where all the old European embassies were housed during the Ottoman Empire, and executed a series of squealing turns. The car stayed upright despite the protesting tires, which told Austin that the driver was a professional who knew the limits of his vehicle. There had been no attempt to blindfold Austin, and he wondered if this meant he had a one-way ticket to oblivion. As the car continued to hook left and right through the urban warren, he concluded that a blindfold was unnecessary. He didn't have a clue where he was. The fact that they hadn't killed him offered slim solace. He knew instinctively that these men would not hesitate to use the weapons they had brandished in his face. After several minutes, during which the city lights faded to a glow, the car whipped down a darkened, garbage-strewn street and into an alley not much wider than the vehicle. Austin's companions hustled him from the taxi and stood him against a brick wall while they bound his hands behind his back with duct tape. Then they pushed him through a doorway along a dim hall and into the lobby of an old office building. Grime covered the marble floor. On one wall was a brass floor directory, black with the patina of age. The smell of onions and the muffled cry of a baby indicated that the office building was being used for human habitation. Probably squatters, Austin surmised. His escorts nudged Austin into an elevator and stood behind him. They were hulking men, as big or brawnier than Austin, who had never considered himself to be a pygmy. The space was cramped, and Austin stood with his face pressed against the cold wrought iron of the ornate gate. He guessed that the elevator must date back to the time of the Sultans. He tried not to think of frayed and neglected cables as the elevator slowly jerked and rattled up to the third and last floor. The elevator was more nerve-wracking than the speeding car. The elevator cracked to a stop, and one of his escorts growled in his ear. "Out." He stepped into a dark hallway. One man grabbed the back of Austin's shirt in a bunch, used it to steer him forward and break him to an abrupt stop. A door opened and he was maneuvered inside. There was the odor of old paper and oil from long-ago business machines. He felt pressure upon his shoulders, then the edge of a chair bumped against the back of his knees. He sat down and squinted into the darkness. A spotlight flashed on, and Austin saw sunspots as the glare hit him in the face. He blinked like a suspect being given the third degree in an old gangster movie. A voice speaking in English came from behind the spotlight.
"Welcome, Mr. Austin. Thank you for coming."
Something about the voice sounded familiar, but he couldn't place it.
It was an invitation I couldn't resist.
A dry chuckle issued from the darkness.
"The years haven't changed you, have they?"
"Do I know you?" A memory clawed at the back of Austin's mind like a cat scratching softly at the door.
"I'm hurt that you don't remember me. I wanted to thank you in person for the lovely bouquet of flowers you sent to hasten my convalescence. I believe you signed the card with the name of John Doe."
Austin was stunned.
"I'll be damned," he said, with a curious mixture of delight and foreboding. "Ivan!"
Chapter 9. The spotlight snapped off and a portable table lamp came on, illuminating the face of a man in his 40s. He had a broad forehead and high cheekbones and would have been handsome if not for the massive scar defacing his right cheek.
"Don't be alarmed, Mr. Austin," Petrov said. "I'm not the Phantom of the Opera."
Austin's mind flashed back 15 years to the Barents Sea. He remembered the frigid waters penetrating his heated dry suit as he activated the timer on 200 pounds of explosives. It was a miracle the Russian was still alive.
"Sorry about the booby trap, Ivan.
Can't say I didn't warn you to stay clear."
"No apology necessary. Simply a misfortune of war."
He paused, then said, "I've wondered something for a long time. Suppose our places had been reversed. Would you have listened to a warning from me?" After a moment's reflection, Austin said, "I might have assumed, like you, that the warning was a diversion. I'd like to think discretion would have won over valor, but I can't say for sure. It was a long time ago."
"Yes, it was a very long time ago."
Petrov's lips widened in a sad smile.
"Obviously, discretion did not rule over my youthful impatience. I was impetuous in those days. Don't worry. I bear you no animosity for the fruits of my own foolishness. I would have killed you long ago if I thought you were entirely to blame. As I said, c'est la guerre. In a sense, you are as disfigured as I am, only you can't see the scars that cover your heart. The war made hard men out of both of us."
"I recall hearing that the Cold War is over. I have a suggestion. Why not ask your friends to give us a lift to the bar at the Palace Hotel? We can talk about old times over a drink."
"In time, Mr. Austin, in time. We have a matter of grave importance to discuss."
Petrov's voice had gained a businesslike edge, and his eyes drilled into Austin's face.
"I would like to know what you were doing at the abandoned Soviet submarine base on the Black Sea."
"Seems I was naive to think our brief visit went unnoticed."
"Not at all. It's a desolate part of the coast. Under normal circumstances, you could have landed a division of Marines without detection. We've kept the area under surveillance for months, but we were caught off guard. We know from intercepted radio messages that you landed some sort of aircraft and that the Numa ship came in to pick you up. Please tell me what you were doing on Russian territory. Take your time. I'm in no hurry."
"I'll be glad to fill you in." Austin squirmed in his chair. It might help my memory if I weren't sitting on my wrists. How about loosening the tape? Petrov thought briefly, then nodded. I consider you a dangerous man, Mr. Austin. Please don't try anything foolish. Petrov gave a sharp order in Russian. Someone came up from behind. Austin felt a cold blade against his wrists, and the tape was severed in a single swipe. Now, for your story, Mr. Austin. Austin massaged the circulation back into his arms. I was on the Numa survey ship Argo conducting a study of wave action in the Black Sea. Three American television people were supposed to rendezvous with our ship, but they had heard about the old sub-base before they sailed from Istanbul and decided to check it out without notifying us of their change in plans. They were overdue, and I went looking for them. Some men on shore murdered a Turkish fisherman who was bringing the TV people to shore and attempted to kill them, too. Tell me about these killers. There were about a dozen of them on horseback and wearing Cossack uniforms. They even carried swords and old rifles. Really old. Then what happened? Austin laid out a detailed narrative of the fight. Petrov listened impassively, although from his experience with Austin's resourcefulness, he was not surprised at the way the battle had ended. An ultralight, Petrov said with a chuckle. An ingenious tactic, using your flare gun. Austin shrugged. I was lucky. They were using antique weapons. Otherwise, my story would not have a happy Hollywood ending. You couldn't have known from the air that they were using old rifles. I assume you must have landed. In a manner of speaking, old or not, those rifles made a sieve out of my plane's wings. I crash-landed on the beach. What did you see besides the weapons? Every detail, please. We found the body of one of the attackers behind the sand dune. He was dressed like the others? That's right. Fur hat, baggy pants. I found this on one of them. He reached into his pocket and dug out the emblem he had taken from the dead Cossack's hat. Petrov studied the pin without expression and passed it to one of his men. Go on, he said. After I confirmed that the TV people were okay, I called my ship in. They picked us up and we left as soon as we were able. We found no evidence of a body or weapons, Petrov said. I don't know what happened to the body. Maybe his friends came back after we left and tidied up. We took the weapons with us. That's larceny, Mr. Austin. I prefer to call it spoils of war. Petrov dismissed Austin's reply with a wave of his hand. No matter. What of this television crew? Did they film any of this? They were too busy running for their lives. They filmed the body, but without an explanation, I doubt if they can do much with it. I hope, for their sake, that you are right. Let me ask you a question, if I may, Ivan. I'm the one asking the questions. I'm aware of that, but it's the least you can do in return for the beautiful flowers I sent you. I've already repaid your kind gesture with one of my own. I didn't kill you. But go ahead. I'll allow one question. What the hell is this all about? A slight smile tweaked the ends of Ivan's lips, and he picked up the cigarette pack in front of him. Extracting a cigarette with great care, he put it between his lips, lit the end, and blew the smoke from his nostrils. The strong tobacco smell filled the office and drove out the musty odor. What do you know about the current political situation in Russia? What I read in the papers. It's no secret that your country has big problems. Your economy is shaky. Organized crime and corruption are worse than Chicago under Capone. Your military is underpaid and unhappy, your healthcare system is a mess, and you've got independence movements and civil wars nibbling around your borders. But you've got an educated and energetic workforce and abundant natural resources. If you don't keep shooting yourself in the foot, you may come out okay, but it will take time. A reasonably accurate summary of a complicated scenario. Ordinarily, I would say you are right, that we would muddle through. Our people are used to adversity. Thrive on it, in fact. But there are forces at work that are much more powerful than anything we have talked about. What sort of forces? The worst kind. Human passions, whipped into a fiery nationalism by the winds of cynicism, dismay, and hopelessness. You've had nationalist movements before. True, but we've managed to marginalize them, blackmail the proponents, or demonize them as eccentric cranks before they could build up their cause and bring others into it. This is different. The new movement has sprung whole from the steppes of South Russia along the Black Sea, where the Neo-Cossacks live. Cossacks? Like the crew I met the other day? That's right. The Cossacks were originally outlaws and fugitives, nomads who drifted into South Russia and the Ukraine, where they formed a loose federation. They were known for their horsemanship, a skill that helped Peter the Great defeat the Ottoman Turks. In time, they evolved into a military class. Cossacks served as an elite cavalry for the Tsars, who used them to terrorize revolutionaries, strikers, and minority groups. Then came the Bolshevik Revolution. The Tsar fell, and the Cossacks ended up driving cabs in Paris, Austin observed. Not all were so lucky. Some joined the Bolsheviks. Others became staunch defenders of the last of Imperial Russia, even after the Tsar and his family were assassinated. Stalin tried to neutralize or eliminate them, but he was only partially successful. To this day, the Cossacks are a warrior caste who believe that they embody the glories of a pure Mother Russia. There is a word for it, Kazachestvo, Cossackism. The idea that they are the ones chosen by a higher power to dominate inferior races. Austin was getting restless. The Cossacks aren't the first to think they were chosen to set the rest of the world straight. History is full of groups that have come and gone, leaving a high body count behind them. True. The difference is that those groups are chapters in a history book, while the Cossacks and their blind faith are very much alive. He leaned forward onto the desk and leveled his gaze at Austin. Russia has become a violent place, and violence is the life's blood of the Cossack. There has been a great revival of Kazachestvo. Neo-Cossacks have taken over parts of Russian territory around the Black Sea. They ignore the Moscow government, knowing that it is weak and toothless.